in the UN Charter. So it's really a group that gave itself power that the other 188 countries of the world look on and say, what is this? We need change. I would say the country that is most amazed and frustrated by this, in fact, is India. India is now the most populous country in the world. The United States has 335 million, roughly, in the population. Britain, France, roughly 60 million. India, 1.4 billion, not on the Security Council, a nuclear power, a world superpower, the president of the G20 this year, really not happy about that. Brazil, the largest economy of South America, similarly not on the Security Council. So this has been an issue for more than 20 years. The P5 in various ways have blocked particular countries, but added up, the P5 have said, you know what, this is our club. We want to stay as the permanent five. But I think as we really face the reality of it's not just a post-US dominated world, but actually a post-Western dominated world, because it was the US as the dominant power among the so-called West, which means the US, Britain, European Union, and honorary Western membership, Japan, let's say. But we're post-Western as well as post-US in dominance. And these international institutions will need to change, or they won't function in the 21st century. And if they don't function, it's actually a disaster for us. If they didn't exist, we'd have to make them, because we need them to function. So we also need to renovate them.
I wanted to talk about China negotiating these various agreements. Let's turn to Brazil's President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, speaking before his meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping.
What does Putin want? Putin can't keep Ukraine's territory. Maybe we don't even discuss Crimea, but he will have to rethink what he has invaded. Also, Zelensky can't have everything he wants to demand. NATO will not be able to set itself up at the border, so this is something we have to put on the table. I think this war has dragged on for too long. Brazil has already criticized what it had to criticize. Brazil defends each nation's territorial integrity, so we disagree with Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Because it looks like Ukraine is on the verge of a major counteroffensive against Russia, and in order to do this needs massive support from Western countries, meaning military weapons. Can you talk about what China's role is here, the peace plan it has put forward, but also these other deals that China is helping to negotiate, like the successful rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and then what they're suggesting about Israel and Palestine?
President Lula uttered in a few words the core of this issue that most of our media dare not explain to the American people, and that is the expansion of NATO. This is a war fundamentally about the U.S. attempt to expand a U.S. military alliance to Ukraine and to Georgia. Georgia is a country in the Caucasus, also on the Black Sea. The U.S. strategy, going back decades, has been to surround Russia in the Black Sea with Ukraine, Romania, Bulgaria, Turkey, and Georgia, all NATO members surrounding Russia and its naval fleet in the Black Sea, with a naval fleet that has been the Black Sea naval fleet of Russia since 1783. Russia has said, this is our red line. And it has said that for decades. And it said this clearly in 2007, before George W. Bush Jr. had the harebrained idea to announce in 2008 and force NATO to announce that that Ukraine will be a member of NATO. And this is what President Lula was saying and what President Xi Jinping of China has been saying. We can't have a war that is essentially a proxy war between Russia and the United States over the expansion of the U.S. military alliance right up to a 1,200 kilometer and more border with Russia, which Russia views, and I would say understandably views, as a fundamental national security threat to Russia. Keep some space, keep some distance. That's President Lula's meaning. That's what China means when it says in its peace plan, we want a peace plan that respects the security interests of all parties. What that is code word for saying, make peace, end the war, but don't expand NATO right up to the border. The American people have not heard an explanation of this all along. It's shocking to me because as a close observer of this for 30 years, this has been the casus belli. And yet our newspapers won't even report the background to this. But this is why China, South Africa, India, Brazil are saying we want peace, but we don't want NATO expansion as the meaning of so-called peace. We want the big superpowers to give each other some space and some distance so that the world isn't on a knife edge. That's exactly what President Lula was saying, and it's exactly what the meaning of the Chinese peace initiative is to say, yes, absolutely make peace, protect Ukraine's sovereignty and its security, but no to NATO expansion. But the Biden administration won't even discuss this issue. That has been the major failing and the reason why we have not been able to get to the negotiating table, in my opinion. Even when Zelensky said in March 2022, maybe not NATO, maybe something else, Russia and Ukraine were close to an agreement, and the United States intervened with Ukraine and said, we don't think that's a good agreement, because the U.S. neocons, so-called, have been pushing for NATO enlargement as the core of this issue. But this goes back to the more general point for us, which is that what is at stake in Ukraine and over Taiwan and many other issues from the point of view of China or Russia or other countries, including Brazil, now Saudi Arabia, Iran, and others, is whether the U.S. does what it wants to do or whether the U.S. respects some limits based on what other countries say, well, this is what we think, so that we need true multipolarity, not U.S. dominance alone. Rules written by all of us, not rules written just by the United States.
And Jeff Sachs, we only have about a minute left, but I was wondering if you could comment on the parallels between this expansion of NATO further and further east in Europe. This year marks the 200th anniversary of the Monroe Doctrine, of President Monroe declaring to all the European powers that the Western Hemisphere was off limits to them attempting to move their forces and their militaries into Latin America. And for these past 200 years, Latin America has essentially been the major sphere of influence of the United States. And yet here we are saying that Russia has no right to declare that its immediate the countries in immediately its borders cannot welcome in NATO troops.
Well, yes, a little empathy would go a long way and would have spared us actually a lot of wars. But for Americans, it would be useful to think, suppose Mexico made a military alliance with China. Would the United States say, well, that's Mexico's right. What are we going to do about it? Or might there be actually an invasion in short order or something like that? I would strongly advise to China and Mexico, don't try it at home. Don't experiment with this. But the United States government refuses that empathy because, in other words, refuses to put itself in the position of the other side. That's the fundamental arrogance of thinking that you determine the rules of the world. The problem with arrogance is not only the comeuppance from it, but you stumble into terrible crises that you don't even understand because the United States has not been allowed, the public has not been allowed to even think from the perspective of the other side. So the analogy is actually a very, very clear analogy. It is what China and Russia and others say all the time is, why have those double standards? Why don't we actually deal with each other with mutual respect, not with the rules that you write?
We want to thank you, Jeffrey Sachs, for joining us, director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University, president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network. We'll link to your new article, The Need for a New U.S. Foreign Policy. Professor Sachs was speaking to us from Cordova, Spain. Next up, we look at the firing of Tucker Carlson at Fox News. Stay with us. Frank Wan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to the firing of Tucker Carlson. On Monday, Fox News announced it had, quote, agreed to part ways with its most popular host. It remains unclear why Fox fired Carlson, who is known for promoting far-right and white nationalist ideas and guests. Over the years, Carlson embraced the racist Great Replacement theory and other anti-immigrant views, compared the January 6th insurrectionists to sightseers who are peaceful, orderly, and meek. Carlson also recently called on Texas Governor Greg Abbott to pardon a man who was just convicted of murdering a Black Lives Matter activist. Tucker Carlson's firing came a week after Fox agreed to pay $787 million in the largest media defamation suit in this country to settle a suit by Dominion Voting Systems for airing false claims about the 2020 election. Emails and texts released as part of the lawsuit show Carlson repeatedly criticized Fox management, as well as Donald Trump, who he privately described as a demonic force, a destroyer. Other messages showed Carlson privately did not believe Trump's lies about the election, but he never told his audience this. Carlson was also named in a new lawsuit filed by former Fox News producer Abby Grossberg, who's described a culture of sexual harassment and general misogyny at the network. Carlson's top producer, Justin Welles, was also fired Monday. In 2017, Blake Neff, one of Carlson's top writers on the show, resigned after it was revealed he had written deeply racist and homophobic remarks in online white supremacist forums and message boards. For more, we're joined by Madeline Peltz, deputy director of Rapid Response at Media Matters, where her two new pieces are headlined with Tucker Carlson out, other Fox extremists now have the spotlight, and Tucker Carlson is out at Fox News. Here's a brief look at his hatred and conspiracy theories. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Madeline. If you can start off by talking about what you understand. I mean, all of this obviously increased Fox's viewership. They did not take him off the air before. This comes right after this $750 million settlement with Dominion. Talk about what you understand happened.
It's difficult to overstate the impact that this will have on the cable news universe in terms of what led to this stunning decision. There's a number of factors floating around in the air. Media reporters have given disparate reports over the last 24 hours, but I imagine that there was some, it has at least something to do with the Abby Grossberg lawsuit. You can see that on air, his treatment of women, of the Me Too movement, of speaking up about sexual harassment has been met with derision and mockery. And so it would be, it would make a lot of logical sense for that to be a attitude that was reflected behind the scenes. But again, it's Tucker Carlson was a kingmaker at Fox News in the Republican Party, and the Murdochs stood behind every single outrage cycle that happened as a result of his on-air racism. And so if we know one thing, it wasn't his on-air commentary. And I think that we will learn more in the coming days about what exactly happened behind the scenes.
And could you expound a little bit about his influence on the Republican Party?
Absolutely. I think you can see it in how some of the Senate nominees shook out in the 2022 midterms. He was a singular force in driving the candidacy of J.D. Vance. That he has been a rallying point for the Republican Party's opposition agenda under the Biden administration. But under the Trump administration, he had this unique ability to speak to what was going on in the White House and influence it via his primetime show. There were times where segments not only led to Trump tweeting in direct response in real time, but also issuing directives for his administration via Twitter. And as you mentioned with the segment on Greg Abbott's pardon and also Abbott sending National Guard troops to the border, both of those were driven by Tucker Carlson. And there is simply no one who has allowed, who in the past 6-7 years has been able to exert that type of influence over the Republican Party, and it creates a major vacuum in the right-wing media ecosystem.
And Madeline Peltz, if you can talk about, I mean, before this was O'Reilly who went down over sexual harassment, and then you have Tucker Carlson. If you can talk about the other people, now there's going to be rotating hosts, but it seems anyone in that position increases the visibility of Fox News, that this isn't a singular issue of one man, however white nationalist, racist, anti-immigrant, xenophobic he was.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the sexual harassment, you know, this alleged culture of sexual harassment, this is an issue that extends back to the founding of Fox News, set from the very top. Roger Ailes was forced out after it was revealed that he, what some women who worked under him described as a reign of terror via sort of sexual blackmailing, hiring of private investigators to quash their complaints. So it's part of a larger culture at Fox News in terms of the future of the 8 p.m. hour. In many ways, Tucker Carlson got lucky. The 8 p.m. hour at Fox News is an institution in and of itself, largely because of the legacy of Bill O'Reilly. And Tucker just stepped into those shoes. And so he sort of had a built-in floor of an audience. And that will continue with the that will continue with whoever takes over the 8 p.m. hour. With that said, the bench is very shallow within Fox News. There are not a lot of people who, from where I'm sitting, are in a position to step into this legacy hour. With that being said, the digital right-wing media sphere is extremely overcrowded and has a number of viral personalities that could come in from the outside. And in the meantime, the rotating host model is something that they instituted for the 7 p.m. hour when Martha McCallum was fired. And they maintained a rotating host for, I believe, over a year, at least a year. And so it could be a long time before someone steps up. But within Fox News, there's simply no one who can come close to the influence that Tucker Carlson has had over the last few years.
Well, I wanted to ask you, last night, Donald Trump had his first TV appearance since Carlson's ouster, and he did it on Newsmax, a right-wing rival of Fox News. As we head into the 2024 elections, is this a sign of there's going to be a growing battle between these right-wing outlets?
I think that Newsmax is attempting to take advantage of the moment. It's the same thing that happened when there was backlash to the Fox position, specifically the Arizona call in the 2020 election. There was a slight bump in ratings for alternative right-wing news channels like Newsmax and One American News, and that was not something that held. And so I think that given the Newsmax's own volatility with regard to their carriage over the last few months, they are just trying to insert themselves into the headline of this massive story in media. And I don't think that it's something that is really going to stick. I think that Donald Trump's comments on Newsmax last night and his praise of Tucker Carlson and general deference to Fox shows the continued power that the network has, that this famously unrestrained figure, former president, did not bring down his most inflammatory commentary on Fox News for Tucker Carlson, but sort of staked out a wait and see position. And so I think that that's also telling.
Well, Madeline Peltz, I want to thank you for being with us, Deputy Director of Rapid Response at Media Matters. We'll link to your pieces with Tucker Carlson out, other Fox extremists now of the spotlight, and Tucker Carlson is out at Fox News. Here's a brief look at his hatred and conspiracy theories. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In addition to announcing his bid for re-election in 2024 today, President Biden has signed an executive order establishing an Office of Environmental Justice within the White House. Biden unveiled his plan at a ceremony in the Rose Garden Friday, just ahead of Earth Day.
Environmental justice will be the mission of the entire government, woven directly into how we work with state, local, tribal, and territorial governments. This is an order that directs the federal agencies to address gaps in science and technology. For example, there's a lot we still don't know about the quality of people's wastewater or the air they're breathing.
Environmental groups welcome the announcement, but caution Biden remains a major supporter of fossil fuels, having approved drilling projects on federal land faster than Trump did during his first 2 years in office. For more, we're joined in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at the Roundhouse. That's where the New Mexico legislature is housed. We're joined by Jade Begay, Director of Policy and Advocacy at the NDN Collective. She's on the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council. She's speaking to us today in her personal capacity, a citizen of Tasuque Pueblo and also Diné and Southern Ute. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Jade. Can you talk about this office that has been set up? And if you could comment on President Biden announcing his campaign for re-election today.
Yeah, good morning, Amy. Great to be here. Well, it's this entire executive order is really exciting. I'm really excited about what it means for our tribes and moving us from an era of consultation to an era of consent. I'm excited about what this means for strengthening our regulatory processes, which have impacts on the projects that you mentioned, the harmful projects that we're seeing approved. Hopefully with this order, we'll see the regulatory process mean more justice for our communities. As far as the office, you know, we're excited that that is happening. That's never been done before, and it signals to us that environmental justice is not just a program or not just a, you know, a proclamation. There's going to be real people working on this day in, day out in the White House, making sure that there's accountability, making sure that there's transparency, and making sure that there's real teeth to this executive order. As far as the announcement around the re-election bid, I feel excited to motivate the people I work with, because really we know what's at stake. And I think as far as my own personal opinions go, there's one option here.
And does this executive order, from what you can tell, have any real or strong enforcement mechanisms? And how would it, for instance, affect the exposures to toxins in the tribal communities where you are in the Rio Grande Basin?
Yeah, so it definitely does. I kind of want to broaden out. Projects, as Amy mentioned, there have been harmful projects approved by this administration. And I think a couple of things can be true at one time. Yes, those actions have been taken. Also, the administration just took the strongest action it can take to embed environmental justice into the DNA of the entire federal government. So now with this executive order, and this is the part that I'm really excited about, is that federal agencies have to think about, analyze, do research on cumulative impacts for new projects and also their own operations. Prior to this executive order, when a new project or new infrastructure like a power plant or a pipeline was proposed, the agency only had to do research or analysis on the pollution and emissions of that project in isolation, not accounting for all the emissions and pollution of the past or present. So with this new order, they have to take into account all pollution, past, present, future. And that's really going to lead to seeing some more justice and seeing less sacrifice zones, especially in my community.
And in terms of the response of Republicans, some key Republican leaders saying this is basically more government waste directed at this effort, your response?
That's an interesting response. I haven't really paid attention to what Republicans are saying. The fact of the matter is Republicans are steadfast working on their H.R. 1, this Energy Savings Act, which is essentially trying to dismantle some of our bedrock environmental protections like NEPA. When we really, especially frontline communities like the community I come from and the communities impacted first and worst by environmental injustice, need those regulations and policies strengthened. And that's what this executive order does.
Well, Jay Begay, we want to thank you very much for being with us, Director of Policy and Advocacy at the NDN Collective on the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council, speaking to us in her own capacity. She's a citizen of Tesuque Pueblo, also Southern Ute and Diné. We thank you so much for being with us from the Roundhouse, the Capitol Building in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. To see our shows and podcast, video, or audio, you can go to democracynow.org. You can also get our daily digest. Just go to democracynow.org to sign up. Also, to see the various topics we cover throughout the years, our 27 years, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 21st to the 25th. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, film, and art in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Featuring genre-defying indie alternative artist Barty Strange as guest curator, garage rock Chameleons Osseys, Chicago-based indie rock three-piece Dead, Latin folk innovator Helada Negro, Toronto's viral hip-hop sensation Akintoye, gothic folk artist Emma Ruth Rundle, alternative R&B hip-hop artist Amindi, and plus many more. There's 150 artists yet to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.